Welcome to our discussion segment on Associating Evil. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started. Joe, I understand you have something you want to address at the very start of this
discussion. I do. So we got a great email from a fan of the podcast who heard the pop quiz from last week about the PSYOP that you and I talked through.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did not do was define what a PSYOP was at the onset.
Oh, interesting.
That was our mistake. So okay. I wanted to
create... Joe, what is a PSYOP?
A PSYOP is a federal action that aims to influence perception. It's an intentional deception intended to help people formulate opinions to go the way that you want them to go.
Okay. Well, thank you to our eagle-eyed fan named Randall out there. We appreciate you catching that for us. And we will do our best to define terms going forward.
Absolutely.
And speaking of PSYOPs, Joe, let's talk about LBJ versus Ho Chi Minh. This was a really, really good episode. I think one of your top five.
That
was excellent. I want to start with the Gulf of Tonkin incident because I think that was the defining moment, certainly in foreign policy, but you could argue in all of Lyndon Johnson's presidency. Can you give us a little bit more insight into exactly how the CIA was able to fool the American people into believing that an attack had taken place? I know there's no social media or any kind of major electronic internet communications like we have today. But how did that work? What did they do? Did they manufacture evidence? Did they bribe people to say that there was an attack? And then did the press play a role in covering up the truth? Did anyone know in the press what had actually happened, and did they suppress it? Or give us a little bit more insight on that.
Yeah, of course. So the reason why it was so effective is because there was one attack. There was an attack on the Maddox, which didn't result in any casualties or any damage to any ships. So there's a question historically, was it an attack or not?
Mm-hmm.
There was I'll call it a confrontation. So the Maddox responded by firing at these boats. Those boats left. And after that, there was a report of the second attack. Now, that's the one that did not happen. It's completely conjured.
That was on the Turner Joy, correct?
Correct. As a result of that attack that did not happen, there were military reports that came out that this thing did occur. There was
falsified report.
Falsified.
Okay.
There were already conversations federally about increasing America's involvement in Vietnam. And this came at the right time for them to actually accomplish that. So when you're thinking about how the CIA was able to do it, pretty easily, because that was top secret information that supposedly they decided to release. And then when Johnson went on national TV and told the American people that this attack occurred, it was pretty hard to verify. There were individuals who tried to verify it. There also were members of the press corps who were asking questions. We know about the Maddox. We've heard this. This has been corroborated. This is something that we know for sure, but this other thing we're unsure about. Those people were silenced. By silenced, there was probably intimidation.
Kind of don't ask questions you don't want the answer to.
Exactly, yeah. So, but that was not the majority of the press. The reason why it was easy to do was because the CIA was not in the habit of releasing information anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So once they did, and Johnson got on national TV, which had a lot more power back then
for
a president to have a national address, now it's kind of like, so what? But back then, it really changed hearts and minds. And so he did that on purpose. He knew that it did not happen. He knew that it was false. He was aware of it, but he wanted more involvement in Vietnam. He wanted the United States to get more involved.
And this has all been verified now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So as a result of that, he lied. And then to verify that story, it was just a lot harder. So those who tried were told to stop, but the majority of the press went along with that.
Hmm.
What would have been wonderful is if there had been the same pushback against that as we saw in Watergate, as an example.
Okay.
But it just didn't happen.
Or the war in Iraq or something like
Correct.
That.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in the months that followed, you know, the USS Turner Joy, not attacked. That was a real ship, and it was stationed in Southeast Asia, but eventually it had to come home.
Sure.
So did anyone talk to the crew, to the officers? Did anyone look at the ship and go, wait a minute, there aren't any giant holes blown into it, or there's no evidence of an attack? Or by that point, was it kind of a moot point because troops are already on their way to Vietnam?
By that point, there was enough the momentum that, I don't want to say no one cared, but it wasn't the focal point anymore.
Okay. Now, in President Johnson's mind, and in the minds of everyone in the defense establishment, actually, before I ask you that question, first another one. Did the DOD have a role in falsifying these reports?
Yes.
And were they ever, were the officials involved ever prosecuted? Were they ever sanctioned at all?
No. The falsification of the Gulf of Tonkin incident came out in the late 2000s.
Okay.
So
they're either dead or retired at that point. Okay. Yeah.
It may be tempting to ask why people didn't, after the Vietnam War ended, why they didn't go back and review it more. Again, by that time, the concentration wasn't on how the war began. The concentration was on how the war had ended.
Yeah.
Not just that, but the men and women who came back from it didn't want to talk about it.
Sure.
And it just, it wasn't top of mind anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll come to that. Go ahead. Sorry.
And that's one of the things that is interesting, because when the falsified information was revealed, people cared, but not really. Hmm. That to me, subjectively, would have been a milestone to say the intelligence communities at that time falsified information that led to the United States getting involved in a war. But when it came out, it was like, oh, well, that's crazy. That's mm-hmm. crazy. And it is, but it's more than crazy. It's criminal. So it was really interesting. I remember reading the article about it, and a lot of strong words in the article, but in the following days after the story broke, it just went away. Mm. Now it's an academic point.
Right.
It's like the Gulf of Tonkin incident was falsified. Yeah, it was. And we went to war. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that had something to do with the fact that just a few years before that information was released, the United States had gone to war in part under false pretenses of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And we now know the CIA had either lied or exaggerated the claims that Saddam Hussein had had.
It could have been, yeah. I don't know if people were war weary, where they didn't, again, they were concentrating on that conflict in Vietnam. For some, were so far away, mm-hmm. it was like ancient history.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just not sure, but it is really interesting. We read about these milestones in history that when something like that comes to light, we should stop and we should review it and be like, oh, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
You openly lied about this incident in order to grant a U.S. president unilateral power to increase deployments to a foreign land to fight in a war that had no effect on our freedom.
Mm-hmm. Why did he feel it was necessary to lie to the American people? Why not present the facts, submit it to Congress, and go for a formal declaration of war rather than this kind of backhanded way of getting the military authorization and starting the war that way, or escalating the war that way?
One, it would have been harder to garner American support, that the American people were probably tired of war. Two, it would have taken longer because he would have had to not only convince the American people, but also Congress.
True.
And three, he didn't want to wait that long. He he's like, I've decided to do this, so we're going to do this.
Interesting. One of many reasons why I could never see myself in the Oval Office making those kinds of decisions, having global consequences hang on each one.
That's actually a great thing to talk through real quick. Could Johnson have known that Vietnam was going to end the way it did? No.
No.
No, absolutely not. He was absolutely sure that Americans would win that fight. And he was right. On the battlefield, Americans did.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. And he didn't live to see the end of that war, did he?
He did not. He died 2 years before it ended.
Hmm. All right. And speaking of, you know, kind of the end of his life, did President Johnson, was he aware of how veterans were treated when they came home? And did he do anything, like a lot of presidents do, in their post-presidency, and his was relatively short, to kind of help those veterans of the war that he had escalated and that he had sent into battle? Did he do anything to try and help them transition back into normal life, try to help them restore the reputations that had been destroyed?
I don't think so. Not in mass, not mm-hmm. in the way that we would think of today. Did he care about those who served after they came? Yes, he did.
Yeah, he was a veteran. I mean, he'd served in World War II, honorably. Yeah,
absolutely. Post-traumatic stress disorder was still a new concept back then. So the veterans who were coming home and going through what they were going through, it didn't even have a name for it.
Yeah. Shell shock or something like that.
Yeah, but if you don't have a name for something, it's hard to pin it down.
Yeah.
His options for how he could help were fairly small. And so did he go to events to support those who came home? Yes. Yeah,
he did. Okay.
Yeah. Did he set up a fund for them? No. You know, did he bring national awareness to those that came home and what they went through over there? No. No, he did not.
Well, and very few people wanted to hear from him.
Correct.
Because of how his presidency ended.
The loudest people protesting the war at that time also did not want to hear from veterans.
Yeah.
They hated veterans. Mm. Veterans who had participated in the draft, had done what they were supposed to do, had gone over there and went through that hell and then sent home. There was one story I heard of a man who was in the jungle, received orders, and 2 or 3 days later is in a hotel room stateside.
Hmm.
That was his transition. Going from in, I mean, he's like, I had mud on my clothes.
Yeah.
Still, I'm in this hotel room.
No idea what to do with yourself,
no,
I would
no,
imagine.
No, no. I mean, he's still in the service, but there was no transition.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go from condition red?
Terror all around you.
Terror all around you to hotel room.
Yeah.
He said, actually, what he did first was he got into the tub and filled it up with his clothes on.
Hmm.
There's no padding between being in combat in a war zone and going to a hotel room. And so a couple days later, you know, after he's still trying to transition, he's in uniform, and his protesters see him and they start spitting on him because they think that he's responsible for what happened over there. Know that we're going to talk about this, but there were American soldiers who, quote, who were just following orders and did atrocious
horrible things. Yeah.
But the majority of them did not.
Yeah.
So I to answer you, yes, he cared about those who came home. Did he bring national awareness to their plight? No, he didn't.
Okay. All right. We'll return to Johnson, but let's switch over to Ho Chi Minh and talk about, I think, the unquestioned villain in this. Although there is a kind of a question mark hanging over that unquestionedness. Is that a word? We're going to say it is. How can a country win a war and lose every major battle? Because that's what North Vietnam did.
Correct.
It's like winning the big game and losing every game in your season.
You would think so, but it's not an apples to apples because...
I know.
The big game
We just saw the big game, and so that's why I brought it up.
Yeah. It's not exactly apples to apples because the big game is governed by specific rules.
Okay.
So there are very clear parameters on what is defined as a win and what is not. American strategy of search and destroy in Vietnam was never clearly defined. Mm. It sounds to the point, but that's not always true. We would send platoon after platoon to take specific hills as an example. Hamburger Hill is an example of that, where American GIs would be mowed down. They would gain the ground. They would gain the hill. They would gain the land. They would plant the flag at the top, and then their superiors would order them to leave the area. That doesn't make sense.
Mm.
That strategy repeated over and over and over again is easy to follow. The NVA and the Viet Cong started to notice that.
Mm-hmm.
When we sent in the air cav into the I Dreng Valley, we fought and we won, but then we left.
Yeah.
We set up supply lines and we gained control, but we didn't keep it. We constantly pulled back. We constantly shifted. The orders weren't always clear. There are some exceptions, like during the Tet Offensive and in Hue City and those types of things where it's an actual direct assault on a city. We kept the city, but the jungle is so challenging to navigate and cross.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult to know, even if you decided to stay on a specific parcel of land, where the enemy was, and then how to track them. When you look at American combat in Vietnam, you see win after win after win after win. You have to look what happened after those wins. Because that, to me anyway, is the defining strategy in Vietnam. There is you see something very inconsistent and very irregular when you look at past wars in comparison.
Mm-hmm. Was part of that because, you know, the World War II analogy, we had, you know, one front in the West heading towards Germany once we got into Normandy and once we'd gotten into France. Whereas in Vietnam, because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, you've got this very narrow border between North and South Vietnam, and then you've got like this 1,000 miles of jungle. Was it the fact that we had poor orders or unclear orders, or was it the simple fact that America is not used to fighting at that time an asymmetric war? Or is it both? Okay, so so it's both. So was there any level of competence that could have been reached at the Pentagon, in your opinion, because you've studied the Vietnam War more than I have, was there anyone in the war who is saying, listen, this is not something winnable with our current strategies. We've got,
yes.
But did they also say, here's what we need to do? Did they present alternatives and say, we need to get into Cambodia. We need to get into Laos.
Yes.
We need to destroy the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They did say that.
Yes.
Okay. And they were ignored.
Correct.
Okay.
There was very
clear. Who ignored them? Was that Johnson?
I think it was a combination of the generals who were back here, mm-hmm. not there. Some of them there. being in Vietnam didn't always mean that you were in combat. If you were in Saigon, you were not in combat. You still had to be careful.
Yeah.
But this, it was far away from any front line. So to your point, you have Cambodia, which we were not allowed to even cross into at all.
And yet sometimes we did.
Absolutely.
Even before the invasion in 72, I think it was. Didn't you tell me a story about there was a target? One map said it was in Vietnam. One map said it was in Cambodia. Yeah. And we're like, we're going to use the one that says it's in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And we blew something up in Cambodia. I love it.
Yeah. It's a combination of, it wasn't a war that we were used to. People on the ground were adapting to understand, okay, this is the actual battlefield that we're trying to encounter. And they would say, here's how to change the strategy. Sometimes those ideas didn't get far up. They would be dismissed. They would be thrown out because this was partly a propaganda war. Mm-hmm. The soldiers in the field started to send information back to the states saying, we're not going to be able to win this with the current strategy. That would obviously affect public opinion of our involvement in the war. So there's a lot of censorship going back and forth at every stage. Mm-hmm. The reports that actually did end up on someone's desk, maybe they were read, but they weren't taken seriously. Instead, we get strategies like dropping chemicals on the jungle to destroy all of the jungle in Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's, and by the way, dropping them on our soldiers too. Mm-hmm. It's
Agent Orange.
Agent Orange. So it's, you know, pilots on these carriers who are loading this concentrated powder under their planes, suffering from cancer and horrible things their entire life as a result of this really stupid strategy. It's like, you know what we should do? We should get rid of all the jungle in Vietnam. That's obviously not viable.
Now, as a counterpoint, that's
Here are the podiums.
Well, but no, that's where the Ho Chi Minh Trail exits were. That's where the VC and the NVA were staging their attacks from. So on paper, it makes sense, correct?
Correct.
Not particularly well executed. That's why I brought up that issue of competence. Did we have bad leaders or did we have bad strategies?
So,
because it sounds like that strategy is not a bad idea.
That is an awesome example. General reading the report at his desk here in the States says, oh, if we get rid of the jungle, we won't have any problems anymore.
Yeah.
Soldier in the field says, yeah, you can get rid of it on the trail. They're just going to make a new trail.
Fair.
And somewhere else in the jungle. We can't get rid of all the jungle in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So they just kept shifting because it took so long for those orders to come through.
Mm-hmm.
So you have soldiers in the field who are trying to compensate for the lack of competency in their leadership by doing what they thought was the best thing they had to do in the moment. Mm-hmm. And again, short-sighted because they're not aware of what everybody else is up to all the time.
Yeah. And that is in direct contrast to, it seems, the excellent working relationship and the excellent strategies created by Ho Chi Minh and his military advisor, military chief, Vo Nguyen Giap. They worked together in perfect harmony, did they not?
Pretty close.
Yeah. Okay. How familiar are you with Vo Nguyen Giap and Ho Chi Minh's strategy called Dao Tran, revolutionary warfare?
Oh.
Quick side story, personal story. And when I was in college, I was this close to being on Jeopardy.
I think I've probably told you this story.
I don't think I've told it on the podcast. I went through all of the trials, and the very last question that determined whether me or some other person went on Jeopardy, it was a history question. I'm like, I got this. And it was about, what was the Vietnamese name of Revolutionary Warfare, or Vietnamese term for Revolutionary Warfare used by Vo Nguyen Giap? Oh no, I don't know this. Now I do, and I will never forget it. It's called Dao Tran, and that's, you know, I'd be on Jeopardy. I'd be a millionaire, Joe, if I hadn't had a whole new career path. Anyway, Revolutionary Warfare, Dao Tran, deals with three aspects. And only the third and really the least important aspect is the military. The other two involve propaganda, and they involve strengthening the homeland. These ideas were tested during the Vietnamese resistance against the French from 1945 to 54.
Right.
And against the Japanese from 1940 to 1945. So they have a tremendous amount of experience, Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap and their soldiers, in waging this same kind of revolutionary warfare. Did anyone in the United States look at that and say, this is what they're doing? It worked in 1945. It worked in 1954. We had better steel ourselves against that.
Yes, but they didn't act on it. It's
another on paper versus in practice.
It's mind-boggling because you're right. They adopted those strategies and honed them through their conflict with the Japanese and then the French and mastered them.
Mm-hmm.
That information was available. The French were interviewed. They were The Americans worked to support them, but it didn't change American strategy in Vietnam. And I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah.
I don't understand why you would not look at history, imagine that, and learn from history and say, you know what, we shouldn't do this. We need to change our strategy, knowing what theirs is, because it's pretty blatant, how to actually defeat them.
Okay.
And I don't know, John, if that goes back to what I was talking about in the podcast regarding ego. Was it ego? Was it, and I don't know, I'm collaborating here.
You mean Johnson's ego?
Johnson's ego.
I would almost say it's America's ego.
That as well.
We beat the Germans. Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
We triumphed in a world war, and now we're being beaten by peasants. I think that might be an explanation. And I know I just kind of ran right over your process there.
No. I want to talk through it for sure. It's more of a, it's just like, why didn't you see what had already happened twice?
Mm-hmm.
And you ignored it. And then when it was happening to you, you still ignored it. And then it was happening again, you still ignored it. You have American soldiers in the field who were saying, this is what's going on. We need to change our strategy. No, it's fine.
Yeah.
We can't change our strategy, because if we change our strategy, it'll show weakness. It'll change American perception of the war. And we need American perception to be at a certain point, and that can't change. Also, to your point, we're Americans. We can handle this. You know, talking about hubris with Xerxes, there's a lot of hubris there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I want to be very clear here. I was not alive during the Vietnam War, despite your many jokes. I grew up, again, around a family who served. I grew up around a lot of people who served, but I was not there. So the criticisms that I have of the administration under Johnson and Johnson himself do not apply to the American soldier or service member who served over there with distinction. So I really want to emphasize that, because they were ordered into a scenario that was almost impossible, and still, by and large, performed exceptionally well.
Yeah. You brought up learning from history, which is a constant theme on this podcast, as it should be. Let's talk a little bit about Ho Chi Minh's history. Sure. It's pretty old, as revolutionary leaders go, when the Vietnam War started. He had a long career. He was educated here in the United States at Harvard in the early teens. He was, I know for a fact, at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919, at the end of World War I, asking the Western powers, listen, as you're carving up the rest of the world after the defeat of Germany, and as you're changing maps and changing the shape of this planet, give us, the Vietnamese people, our independence from the French. If you do that, we will be an ally. We will be your best friend. We will trade with you. Let us have our independence. Your whole document, the Treaty of Versailles, rests on one fundamental principle when it comes to international law: self-determination of peoples. Is that only for white people? Those are the kinds of things he's asking, because as we're talking about, as the leaders at Versailles are talking about self-determination, the Europeans are also gobbling up more colonies in Africa and Southeast Asia.
Yes.
So he failed there. He spent the 20s and the 30s petitioning the French, give us greater independence, greater autonomy. When World War II breaks out, he turns to the Japanese and he says, if you will support us, we will be your best friends. Turns out the Japanese weren't interested in that. They absorbed Indochina into their greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. And so he fought the Japanese. World War II ends. He goes to, I believe it was in London, and he talks to the French and the British again and says, give us our independence. At no point is he talking about Marxism. At no point is he talking about communism. At no point is he talking about land reform or murdering people. He simply wants his people to be independent of Western rule.
Right.
Is it any surprise, and did anyone in the West express surprise, in the 1950s when he reaches out to the communist world, to the Soviet Union, and to China, and say the same thing? Help me, and I will be your best friend, and I will do whatever you need, we'll trade with you, etc., if you help me win my independence from these Western puppets in the South.
Was there surprise when he reached out, or was there surprise when he actually gained power?
I guess both. And really, it boils down to a question, again, of a lot of this is about intentions and motives. I've read historians who say Ho Chi Minh was a Vietnamese George Washington, and our constant either refusal to help him or betrayal when we said we'd help him and then didn't turned him into this communist monster. So I guess I just kind of generally want to get your thoughts on that.
Based on what I've read, when he was reaching out to communists, so China and in the Soviet Union, he was still seen by Western powers as insignificant.
As just a nationalist like so many others.
Because that was the track record. He had gone and made those requests. No one cared what he wanted. No one cared what he was asking for. They were like, no, thanks for your request. We're going to do what we want to do, regardless of what group it was. So when he started to make those actions, people saw it in the same vein. It's like, all right, I don't care. When he gained power is when they started to actually pay attention, because suddenly he has power.
And that was in 1945.
Yeah.
Right? That's the end of the Japanese occupation.
So communism to him was the vehicle by which he could not only organize that independence, but unify it.
Mm-hmm. And sustain it.
Was he a true blue communist at the beginning when he was reaching out to the Chinese as an example? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that over time, when you embrace a philosophy like communism, it does metastasize. So you start believing it because you're applying it. And the behaviors that we've seen throughout history with communism, they're consistencies. We read about the atrocities, the mass murders, the forceful occupation and confiscation of property. All of those things started to happen as a result of his embrace of communism, because from his perspective, it was working. This is something that he was finally able to achieve under this new ideology with the support of other communist nations. I think at first, no. He was as discarded as always. Leaders didn't really care. They may have, some people may have said, hey, you need to watch this. We've seen in history that was not taken seriously. He was ignored. Then when he comes to power and he maintains power and he starts to enforce this communist rule, we see him start adopting communist actions. His goal was to unify Vietnam. His goal was to get the colonialists out of Vietnam. And that's the parallel that I've read when people compare him to George Washington is, George Washington was explicitly trying to remove the British from our colonies with the help of, all of our founders, right? So there were occupiers of his country that he wanted out, and he wanted a unified Vietnam. To your point, he couldn't get any support or advocation from anyone to do so except the communists.
It seems like so many lessons are just right in front of our leaders at this time.
It's really complex. And I want to be clear here. We have a short form podcast.
Yeah.
So sometimes it may come across that, hey, this is really simple. Here's how to say it. This is not simple.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that it is.
No. I don't want to come across as suggesting it is.
Yeah.
And that is certainly, I hope the discussion, as always, has revealed the layers.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had some pretty harsh words about the war on poverty, kind of the signature policy of President Johnson's.
I was echoing harsh words. I have personal views on it, but yeah.
Okay, all right. And I wonder if you can unpack that for our audience a little bit more, why you think that the war on poverty was unsuccessful in its goals and how it fostered a certain mindset in the United States. Also in that, if you can address questions that good, honest, legitimate historians and analysts have raised, saying, listen, yeah, it was flawed, but it did save a lot of people who were in poverty from the terrible effects of poverty. I've just said the word poverty like 9 times there.
I know. Yeah, I was actually going to call that out. I was embarrassing, John.
Sorry.
I am not going to make a flat statement to say that it was an utter failure. There were people who benefited from that in a positive way.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
Millions.
So did they remain in poverty or did they rise out of it? And that is the question that some historians have raised.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at its effects, was one of the main effects of the, quote, war on poverty that people became more dependent on the government support to help, but that was intended to get them out of poverty, but instead it allowed them and facilitated and enabled them to stay there. That's the biggest challenge that I have read. And I don't want to say that I agree with it, but I understand the logic behind it. The government is not capable of charity because it has no money of its own. It brings in money from taxpayers and then is supposed to spend that money on a budget to keep us safe and so on.
Wait, the government's supposed to live on a budget?
Yeah, folks, for those...
Craziness.
For those in our audience who were not alive when there was a balanced budget, that is possible. It has happened. It should be an expectation. Anyway, off of soapbox. So with that in mind, the argument against the war on poverty was that it was creating a sense of actual dependency, that that dependency enabled people to stay exactly where they were rather than helping to get them out of poverty so that they wouldn't need that support anymore.
Okay. So your criticism is not in the necessarily the number of dollars, or the criticism you've read is not in the dollar amount that was spent. It's more in the mindset that it created, the sense of dependency within some people who were in what you would call the poverty-ridden class or the poorer class.
Both, actually. It's the combination of the bureaucracy that was created to facilitate the war on poverty.
Okay.
That sucked up a lot of those funds, and the actual execution on poverty to try and get people out of it. So was the money being distributed to the right people? How much of it actually got there? What happened to those people after they were receiving that support? What were the programs involved in order to help them rise out of that? Was that the intention?
Gotcha.
Was that the intention? And that's honestly something I've read as well. It's very valid to ask that. Was the intention of the war on poverty to get people out of poverty? Some argue no. Some argue the intention was to make people dependent.
Why would Johnson want that?
Because dependency can breed allegiance with one's vote. The more people who are dependent on me and are expecting me to give them something, the more they will enable me to do so.
Far easier to just kill your political opponents like Ho Chi Minh did.
Correct.
His land reforms, are they in any way comparable in terms of philosophy, only philosophy, to what Johnson was doing with the war on poverty? Or is he approaching the issue of social reform and social change from a completely different standpoint?
An analogy that I would use is both may have started from the same acorn, but the trees grew up in different ways.
What was that acorn?
I think that there was a belief that the federal or government arm had the ability to solve all of these problems. I see that as the acorn.
Okay. Seems to be a pretty good argument for free markets over communism. If you look at, you know, the end result of the war on poverty is some people helped, some people more, you know, dependent on government versus the communist model, which is what, 500,000 dead?
Correct.
From his enforced famines and purges after the war ended.
Yeah.
It was at least 500,000.
Yeah.
What is Vietnam like today? What is the legacy of Ho Chi Minh in his country?
Because he died
before the war ended.
Yeah.
So he didn't unify it.
Well,
but his party
did. Yeah. I mean, they're a full communist state. I mean, like most communist countries, they have adopted some capitalist practices.
Is it more like China than North Korea?
Yeah. In China, we see leadership there trying to revert back to a lot of communist practices away from the capitalist side.
Yeah.
That's not going well because people are used to it. They're used to being able to sell things and bring in income.
Yeah.
So I don't think Vietnam is going down that road. Communism in its raw form is unsustainable. So there had to be an adaptation.
Mm. Okay. And what would you say is President Johnson's primary legacy here? If Ho Chi Minh's is a positive one, he unified his country within his own community, within his own society. What is President Johnson's great legacy? We haven't even talked about the Civil Rights Act, which I think was his greatest contribution. But how do you think the American people and American historians have treated him?
It depends on who you read. I mean,
really?
There are historians who treat him extremely well because he signed those two bills.
Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act. Yeah.
But would President Johnson have signed those bills if not for the civil rights movement and the leaders there? No, he would not have.
Yeah.
He would not have done that.
And I was going to get to that very quickly. Yeah.
So,
what were his private views on civil rights and voting rights?
I mean, obviously didn't know him personally, but his language...
He died a couple years before you were born?
Yeah.
When did he die? No, I'm being serious. When did he die? No, it was early 70s. Never mind. I'm sorry. I wasn't trying... One of the rare moments I'm not trying to make fun of Joe for being old. And
he died way before I was born. Anyways.
He died 7 years before you were born. That's not way before.
Anyways. Sorry. Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I'm old. Because those acts that he signed into law were the result of the civil rights leaders pushing them and changing American views on race and on equality, reminding Americans that every person is created equal. I credit those
Dr.
things
King,
being signed.
People like that.
Yes, yeah. When we look back on history, so do most people. Johnson is remembered for Vietnam. He's remembered. It's called Johnson's War.
Yeah.
That is what he is seen as. That's what he's associated with. And that's it. You know, and interesting, even his political, societal things that he pioneered are ancillary to the war in Vietnam.
So we did get a question that came in. I want to ask that, and then we'll wrap up this very, very long discussion. Thank you, Joe, for sticking with it. Joe, I've heard stories of LBJ trying to intimidate members of the press and Congress. I've also heard that he would lose his temper and begin shouting at the press at conferences.
So answer to those questions is yes, absolutely he did.
On domestic policy, he had to fight Congress quite a bit, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he did. So it depends on what you mean by intimidated, like yelling at
them. Well, like physically, because this is not part of the question, but I as I understand it, he's one of our tallest presidents, and he would physically like lean over members of Congress and sure. shout and scream.
But he
and
wouldn't
curse.
Beat them up or anything.
No, I'm not yeah. suggesting that. But I mean, most of his career in the Senate.
Yeah.
And so he knew everybody there. He knew their personal histories. He knew their personal proclivities, stuff that they didn't want to get out. He was a masterful political manipulator, was he not?
Yes, he was.
Okay. And what about his relations with the press?
They were not great.
Okay.
So in terms
compare Johnson to Trump, because Trump also had very, very poor relations with the press.
I think that when it came to the subject of Vietnam, it was not favorable. Mm-hmm. Social policy, favorable. I think signing things into law that affected society in those ways, he got a lot more positive coverage in some areas, not mm-hmm. all of them. When it came to Vietnam, the farther and longer the war went on, the more questions he got to the point where it became Johnson's war. Because more and more people were asking, what are we doing over there? And that would irritate him.
Yeah. Okay. Kind of a complex closing, and I want to wrap some of these themes together that we've been talking about. The overarching question is, most people have a pretty clear definition, pretty clear line between good actions and evil actions in a lot of ways, as far as personal morality.
Sure.
It gets a lot more blurry when you're talking about what governments do, what national leaders do. And then when you throw in culture, that also is going to make things even more murky in terms of defining good and defining evil. So the United States and Vietnam, very different cultures, different economies, different societies.
Right.
Our economic systems, free market versus communism. That's another layer of complexity. And then you take some of the atrocities, some of the events that happened in Vietnam, and you take the motivations of these two men. How do we evaluate? I'm just going to throw a broad question out to you to get us started. How do we evaluate evil within the context specifically of culture? Some of the atrocities, or some of, I guess what you might, maybe not atrocities, some of the evil actions were either lesser in scale than mass murder, or they were seen as good at the time, but they had very, very negative, very long-lasting, very serious negative consequences. You think specifically about the war on poverty, or the land reforms that happened under Ho Chi Minh, that, again, on paper, seemed to make sense. You've got negative outcomes. Does culture affect our assessment, or should culture affect our assessment of those events? Because yeah, we can all agree mass murder is evil.
Yeah. So culture does. Yes. I think that the difference between it being I'll call it a test, when we see something on paper and we say this will work, this will benefit others, or this is what we would consider from our moral, based on our moral compass, this is the right thing to do. I think that what changes is, I think that what further defines it is the tactical application and our honest review of its effects. In the land reforms, if Ho Chi Minh had heard about his men massacring entire towns, redistribute the possessions and the property, and he said, no, that is wrong. We should not do that. Do not do that again. I think that on paper, he would realize this was the wrong action to take because it's violating his, what he knows to be a moral right and wrong. Johnson, again, like war on poverty, you see the application. The intention for some who authored that was good. Mm-hmm. They wanted to help people. They wanted to help people out of poverty. In application, when they started to see, let's say, I'll use the argument that dependency was growing as a result of this, and the majority of people who were receiving funds were not rising out of poverty, then at that moment, they say, oh, this is not working because the intended outcome is not happening. We need to change it. Neither of those things happened. Instead, the war on poverty funded a larger government bureaucracy that continued to grow. There may have been people who said, we need to reform this, we have to change this. There were senators, there were members of the House who passed bills to try and affect it in that way. But overall, it's like at a certain point, when you see the application, it's either working or it's not. And you have to be honest in those moments to say, this is effective or it's ineffective. Hmm. And being honest is one of those moral tests. If it's not working, change it. If it's not working and it's ruining lives, you better change it.
Yeah.
If it is working, fantastic. Then what was on paper, it was correct. The intended outcome is occurring. So we see it progress in the application. And in that moment where the decision is made, I know it's not working. I know it's wrong, but we're still going to do it. That's evil.
Hmm. So it's about what do you do when you have the responsibility to make a change?
If you have the power, influence, and the data, if it's telling you to go a different way or to pivot, and you decide not to because of selfish reasons, then you are deciding to do an evil thing.
Okay. Now let's take another example. And this comes up very often with students. I know you've heard this before. Let's take the land reforms and the massacres in Vietnam committed by Ho Chi Minh and the NVA. And let's compare it to the most famous war crime committed on the American side, the My Lai massacre. Where did that issue of responsibility come in? Because I think that draws a clear line between what Ho Chi Minh was like and what LBJ was like.
Yeah, it's a great question. When you review history and you review that massacre that the American GIs...
The My Lai massacre, yeah.
...were responsible for, it's horrendous. There was a cover-up. It was beyond words terrible. The difference is if the communists saw some of their units conducting such an atrocity, they would not have stopped it. They would have said, this is part of our plan. What happened with the Americans is American chopper pilots who were above it, who were not taking part in it, and some of the men had to stop it. They saw that it was wrong. The lead helicopter pilot landed his chopper so fast when he saw what was going on that he broke the frames that was holding the chopper up. His chopper was still running when he jumped out of it and got between just a couple of the American GIs who were responsible for it, between them and these people that they were slaughtering. Mm. Say, stop, look at yourself, stop what you're doing. His men followed suit. Choppers started to land. They ran in. They said, this is wrong. That is the distinction, is that there is a realization in the moment that that is wrong. We do not act that way. You're going to stop it. Versus the communists under Ho Chi Minh, they wouldn't have questioned it, and they didn't. That is the comparison. Is that there was intervention because of the moral position that the Americans had versus the moral position of the communists, where the ends justified the means.
Brings up another quote, the only thing that's necessary for the triumph of evil is the indifference of good men. All right, and let's wrap up with, again, that old question of responsibility. And I want to go back to kind of where we started with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We talked a lot about the kind of the psychology behind the decision. We talked about the effects. Do you hold President Johnson responsible for every down-the-line effect in Vietnam, negative effect and positive, but I mean for the death, for the treatment of veterans, for everything, because he lied to the American people? Or is he only responsible for the Gulf of Tonkin incident because he was not ordering death and destruction and atrocities? And I want to kind of bring up, it's kind of a counterfactual, please, no shoes thrown at me. Imagine, I know some people think this is conspiracy and it really happened, but probably not. Imagine that President Roosevelt in 1941 had known that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor and he put the Pacific Fleet in Hawaii. That knowledge, does that make him responsible for the atrocities committed, let's say, at the Hurtgen Forest, in the same way it would have made, or maybe it made, Johnson responsible for the war crime at My Lai?
Some historians say yes, some no. You're asking me specifically.
Yes.
Johnson is responsible for all of it.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Johnson was the president of the United States. He was granted unilateral power by Congress to escalate the war in Vietnam as a result of a fake incident. He was responsible for every decision because he was the leader. If FDR had known that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor and he allowed it to happen, then he would have been responsible for every atrocity that followed, because he could have notified, in this fake scenario.
Yeah.
He could have notified armed forces, the Japanese are going to attack, the Japanese would have attacked, and the Americans would have fought them off.
Gotcha.
Or at least had a better chance of fighting them off. We still would have gone to war because the Japanese were going to attack. Johnson is responsible for every American action because he is the leader. The buck stops with him. He started it. He continued it. He didn't pivot. He didn't change. He didn't enforce change. He didn't require change. He continued down this road until it wasn't his problem anymore. That is wrong.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Associating Evil. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Jill Parker.
Please leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. And you can help us continue to grow it by going to 15minutehistorypodcast.org and clicking the support button. Thanks, and we will see you next week.